I think that also this is the best possible proposal that we could bring to you today that is within the jurisdiction of BDS, although there are larger issues in the development community that remain to be addressed.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your help. So, Mr. Zimmer, I think you're next.
Okay. I'm here because...
Let me give a little prelude to this.
Okay.
Early on, we were trying to figure out the whole hazardous material handling issue, and city doesn't handle it. The state enforces it, and they'd never spoken or been in the room together. So I said to Paul Scarlett, can we get him in the room together? And he said, you can. So I got on the phone and called Representative Kotek's office, who happens to be in the Kenton Firehouse and very convenient to me, and said, how can we get these people in the room? The next morning, Chris's boss, Penny Wolf McCormick, called me, and Andrea O'Brien from DEQ called me and said, what can we do to help? So I thought, good. Tina got out her big stick for me. So Andy Short in her office was instrumental in getting these people to contact us, and then Chris came to the meeting, and it's been a very good relationship. And I invited him here today so that you could hear the commitment on the part of the state OSHA. So
great.
That's the background.
Thank you.
So I'm Chris Zimmer with Oregon OSHA. As Mary said, yeah, she invited me here yesterday. So as prepared as I am, basically one of the things I've noticed over the years is I've worked as an inspector, investigator for OSHA for about 18 years, and I've primarily focused on construction-related health hazards. And one of the things that's a primary issue that Mary Helen and the others have run into is lead, paint, and asbestos. Two of the reasons that most of this stuff, you know, pops up in the newspaper, because there's a hazard there for children, families, and, of course, the workers that I regulate. The issue that I've come to realize since I've worked there is that the knowledge base in the construction industry is very limited. For years, it's been overlooked. It's much easier to head into a nice, clean office building, talk to people, inspect them, and, you know, everything's the same every day, and you can leave, and things will remain the same. But construction, its nature is to change every day. And so it's difficult to enforce those things when they're short-term, possibly 1 or 2 days and the whole project's done. In the case of these demolitions that we've looked at and inspected, you know, despite the fact that OSHA has had a you know, these rules, asbestos and lead around for 20 years, I find that the majority of the licensed contractors and homeowners fail to have the necessary education or training to understand what they're doing. And as such, we run into a lot of problems. And it's a result for the community has to deal with it, as well as financially the contractor or the homeowner has. Somebody has to clean it up and deal with the results of those things. So after dealing with this stuff myself for 18 years, I've taken it upon myself to get out and talk to these groups and try to figure out how we can help them. And I've discovered that probably the most efficient way to do that is to try to do outreach. You know, as an enforcement officer, my primary thing is to go out and take a look at what they're doing and ask them to correct it. For years, there was no regulations on lead at all inside of houses. So there was recommendations through the health division, and they would go out and chat with them, but they couldn't require them to do anything. So a lot of that fell to OSHA because we are a regulatory agency, and that's our primary directive. And so I would show up, and in doing so, I could speak to the homeowner, the neighbors, talk to them, ask them about what they've seen, talk to the contractor, the employees. And so everyone now kind of gets an education. And this is the thing that needs to continue to improve. There have been additional regulations that have come out from the EPA and here in Oregon. And because of that, the education and training level, and therefore the safety and health of the neighborhoods, has improved. One of the things that we discussed was creating some more outreach. Something that I proposed, or we as a group we proposed, was providing a training document of some kind that would allow them to not only put their name on the line that said they received something that would protect the neighborhood, but also would give them the education necessary and remind the person that fills out these demolition permits that there are a few primary hazards that are out there in the neighborhoods that we really want to prevent exposure from to the community. And that's one of the things that we've been working on as a group, is to get that lead and asbestos training, that education and a document in their hands, so that they have, number one, an idea and understanding of who's going to enforce these rules, what resources are available, and how they can get those, you know, whether it's through a web page, a phone number, or a contact. Thank you.
Thank you.
He's also agreed, ONI is having their neighborhood summit February 28th, and he and a representative from the construction contractors are going to be there to do some work sessions so that neighborhoods will have exposure to that. So in that area, it was a huge win for us to be able to make that connection. So, I wanted to really bring attention to they've put a lot of effort in that, and he's the only guy in the whole metro region, I think, so taking that time.
I appreciate you being a resource for us. Thank you.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time to do that. It's something that I enjoy doing.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you things you haven't heard or might not know, because you've already heard a lot of it, and I might repeat a couple of things that I think are important. People talked about the number of meetings we went to, and I tried to count them, and some of them weren't on my calendar. But I did come up with a timeline that, you know, DRAC started this discussion at our April 17th meeting and ended in November 20th with the proposal, the resolution that's before you today. So there was 8 DRAC meetings that we discussed this. There were 10 subcommittee meetings, which averages about 3 meetings a month just on demolition. And I've learned more than I ever wanted to know about demolition, construction, et cetera. But maybe that knowledge will come in handy some way. And then I started into the other meetings, like Jeff insinuated about coffee meetings or with Eastmoreland neighbors, or somebody had another neighborhood. So whoever approached us, because there's not really a formal process within BDS, like there are district liaisons in BPS to have little districts and do these things. So I think we did a phenomenal. So I came up with a figure of over 45 neighborhood builders, those kinds of meetings in a period of 6 months, which goes down to like 8 meetings a month. I wanted to bring, and I already mentioned this, but special recognition to the coordination of Andy Short and Representative Kotek's office and getting this connection, because I think it's a huge, huge benefit. Because one of the big things that I heard from the neighborhoods was they wanted increased notification and they wanted to be protected. Really big things. And they wanted K1 to go away. And in our very first meeting in April, everybody said, yeah, it's going to go away. That was the easiest one we got over. But being able to craft and get the information in, it's confusing to everybody, to BDS staff, to neighborhoods, to the state, of who does what and how they can do it and how we can coordinate. That's all coming together. And I think that'll be a huge accomplishment of this whole process. It's not really in code and it's not really a policy, but it'll protect the citizens of Portland. I wanted to speak to Commissioner Fish's question about examples of the use of the 120 days. There are 3 instances in North Portland that didn't use 120 days, that they've been in negotiation with landowners to save properties, Overlook neighborhood in the Oak Savannah, and there's an older house on that. There's one in St. John's and one in Portsmouth. That they
did use or didn't?
Yeah, they did not.
Did not, okay.
They just went on their own and started talking to the owners, and in one case, the owner's actually helping them with fundraising to purchase the property from them. So there's lots of other unique ways to do this, and I think part of the outside-the-box thinking on this is not to hit people with a big stick, but teach them how to use tools that are there, how neighborhoods can raise funds, how they can coordinate and save those things. You'll hear, and I'm sure, and I wanted to emphasize this, we do need to look at an inventory of what's valuable to us in the neighborhoods to help this. If we can do it for trees, we can do it for houses. So we can go out and do that inventory. As far as pulling the levers, I think this committee, and I'm glad that it's an amendment, because that was a really strong point I wanted to make, the follow-up committee, because there's going to be oops in there somewhere that we don't know today sitting here. And Jeff Fish has followed this entire process and invested a lot of his time, and we could all spend a lot of time telling each other how wonderful we were, but my adage has always been, you're only as good as the company you keep. So we had a lot of really good company, and so we got a really good product out of this. And so I think that his ability to stay on and willingness to stay on to serve on this committee is going to be a huge benefit. I think that the suggestion to, and I don't mean this lightly, but the suggestion that there be a committee to look at all the design review issues of the underlying lots and what comes after, there's arguments on both sides. You're going to not, I don't know, because I don't know who's in the audience, but there's not an organized effort of the people that like those houses that are being, but people are buying them and they're living in them. And I'll give you one specific example on Southeast 20th. In Ladd's addition, it's across the street from the historic design. It's a huge monster of a house. It's three stories, 5,000 square feet. It's square. It doesn't look like any of the Portland cottage houses in there. A lot of people don't like that house. I took a friend of mine from San Francisco that lives in those painted little Victorian houses and quaint area by there, and she said, well, that's pretty cool. It's really different. It gives a new character to the neighborhood. I hadn't had that vision before. And I know that people be disagree with me, but there are people that have different visions that think our neighborhoods might need to look different. There might need to be something different. I grew up in a neighborhood in North Portland across from the University of Portland, and there were three houses on the block, and they subdivided and built my parents' house, which was a ranch-style house. And I forever lived with the term of, I was that kid that lived in the ugly house because it didn't look like the other three houses that were on the block. So I kind of understand that, but I think as we grow as a community and a city, we have to realize there's going to be differences, and everybody's going to decide they don't like something, but somebody may. And that came out pretty clear in a lot of neighborhoods. We heard mostly from the people that disagreed, but there were a lot of people that would whisper in my ear after meetings saying, you know, I really do like that house, but I'm afraid. You know, so their voices are just as important. They weren't as loud, and for the most part. And
Mary Helen, maybe what we could have you do is save the rest of your testimony and come back at the end after we've heard from others, because it seems like you're going through some of the things that we're going to be hearing in testimony.
Okay. Can I just say one quick thing before, because I don't know how long people will last here, and I didn't bring my pillow. I threatened to bring a pillow. My special recognition is going to go to Nancy Thornton, because we, throughout this entire process, called her the cat herder. She brought all kinds of people in the room. There was a lot of oftentimes, sometimes contention, and she was able to keep us on track and do all of those things. So I didn't really have a trophy, but I brought her a little presentation piece here. It's a mug, and it says cat herder on it. And I tried to get it here without breaking it.
I think you might have succeeded. You never get it out.
Anyway, here. Because it's, you all know, you've seen me enough times, I've been on enough committees, and they all haven't been stellar, and they all haven't been the best of, Jane says cat herder, so you can see. It hasn't been the best of experiences all of the time, but Nancy did a phenomenal job, and I think she deserves special recognition for that. So, yeah, I'll stick around.
You two have done a phenomenal job. Thank you so much, Mary Helen, for all your work on this.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other DRAC members, Commissioner, that are going to speak, or should we open it up?
I think we should open it up.
Okay, and I understand there's a very large number of people signed up to testify. We'll try to give you an opportunity to do that. If you have heard one of your friends or neighbors say, make your points well, please don't feel any compulsion to be repetitive, but say what she said, and maybe be merciful to not only us, but to your fellow citizens here. So we do want to hear the various perspectives on this issue, but if you think that your points have been well covered, do exercise that option if you'd like.
How many do we have?
Okay.
We have 39 people signed up.
Okay.
The first three, please, coming up are Margaret Davis, Janet Baker, and Barbara Strunk, and they'll be followed by Claire Coleman Evans, Mary Ann Santana, and Al Ellis.
I would like to invite Carolyn Dow from the Landmarks Commission to precede
sure,
our talk.
That'd be great. All right. Okay, good afternoon. Carolyn, the first shot.
Okay. Sure. My name is Carolyn Dow. I live on 4045 North Missouri Avenue. Good afternoon, Commissioners, Mayor Hills, and Commissioner Fitz.
So today I'm speaking to you guys wearing two different hats. I'm going to maybe take a little extra time, but I promise I won't go on and on. So first I want to talk as somebody who has actually used the 120-day delay in my neighborhood association. And so the eight examples in the last year, that was actually one that was successful. And then the second hat is obviously the Landmarks Commission, and we worked on the white paper and the follow-up letter that you guys should have in front of you there. And the second page on the letter is the picture of the house that our neighborhood moved. So I want to start with the neighborhood side because I think that there's, throughout the process, a lot of assumptions were made about how this is used or abused. And so I'll just tell you guys the story of how that house was moved. So in 2013, I was the president of the Boise Neighborhood Association. Boise is covers Mississippi Avenue, North Williams, North Vancouver. And at the time that we got the demolition notice, we were coming off the heels of a lot of major development. We had gone in for a design review appeal, and we're getting ready to go in for another. And we were all pretty exhausted. When we got the demo notice, it was kind of sad for our neighborhood because this particular house is on the cover of the History of Albina. And it's sort of a flagship property. Even though it was a little derelict, it was a prime example of the type of house in that neighborhood. And so we didn't go in for a 120-day delay right away. We were told that there was nothing we could do about the demolition. The way that it was, the owner was a longtime owner. He had lost his job, got foreclosed on. He was in the middle of a home renovations, and so no one could get a traditional loan on the house, so it was bought with cash by a developer. And he put in for the demolition notice right away. So a lot of people approached the developer, tried to buy the house. Will you please renovate the house? And this is all prior, again, to the 120-day delay. And he didn't want to do any of that. He was going to split the lot and build two townhouses. So we were told by Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, since this is a contributing resource on the Albina Conservation District, that we were eligible for the 120-day delay. So as the neighborhood president, I put in for the delay right away. We didn't have a plan, but we knew that we were going to put one together right away. So we started work, contacted Emmer International, since we knew that the only way to save the house was to move it. And he gave a discount of $5,000 and said, if anybody wants the house, it's going to cost you $70,000. So we went out on a social media campaign. Slacktivism, as Commissioner Fritz likes to call it. The developer was vilified right away, and not on purpose. So there was a lot of social pressure on him to do the right thing. The DJC picked up the story, as well as Oregonian. And so, again, there was a lot of social pressure on him, and it became very contentious almost immediately. But we started work, and we looked at what are the open lots in our neighborhood that we could move the house to that's close that would reduce the cost. So we started contacting individual property owners. And then we started contacting people to buy the house and move it. For that $70,000 fee and plus SDC fees and permit fees. So long story short, we utilized the delay. It took well over 120 days. BDS told us right away that it takes a lot longer than 4 months to move a house, and that was true. With the telcos, we end up moving the Killingsworth exit sign, and that takes a while. So we utilized it, and it was successful, and it was really inspirational for the whole neighborhood, and it was a success for us given the amount of development that had been going on at the time. So the second hat is Landmarks Commission, and I just want to echo what everyone else is saying about Nancy Thornton. She was well-prepared. She led us through a lot of really passionate conversations, and I want to point out that there were a lot of successes with the draft resolution. I mean, the K-1 exemption, the increased notification, but the Landmarks Commission does have to take issue with the outright removal of the 120-day delay, because a 30-day by 30-day voluntary extension isn't always possible in a situation where the relationship is contentious. And when there's finances involved and social pressure involved, it may not always be friendly. And I know that there was one point in there where the developer wouldn't have signed that 30-day extension. I believe that. The Landmarks Commission respectfully opposes the outright removal of the 120-day delay because there's really no codified incentive for the developer to engage with the neighborhood. And it's really, so far, we don't see evidence that it has been abused, and it has been successful in one instance. I think it's without protection of our historic properties right now. This is the 120-day delay is our best hope to save some of these gems of our neighborhood. So,
thank you. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Did the Landmarks Commission consider that it was a trade of 35-day delay for everything versus 120 in some instances?
Yeah, I think there was definitely some confusion about that, because the K-1 exemption, the way it was presented at first, was the K-1 exemption was brought into code because some houses were being raised and demolished to make way for larger developments like Legacy Emanuel Hospital and weren't being replaced with anything. So it was a surprise to us that at the last meeting it was stated that they went hand in hand. So that was sort of, and a lot of the reason why I think it may be a surprise that we're opposing this outright is because the way it's explained to us is they belong together, and that wasn't our understanding from the offset, from the outside of this process.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Margaret Davis. I live at 3617 Northeast 45th Avenue. It's an honor to be here. Today you heard recommendations from the Development Review Advisory Committee, in part prompted by a July 31st hearing in these chambers in which the Landmarks Commission sounded the alarm on the epidemic of home demolitions as they entered their second record-breaking year. Members of United Neighborhoods for Reform attended the DRAC meetings dedicated to solving the problem. However, despite some elements we support, overall, we are disappointed by the recommendations and are especially disheartened by proposed code changes that dramatically reduce neighbors' ability to save viable, affordable housing. You will hear more from our members about how we agree, disagree, and even object to the recommendations. My job today is to tell you about United Neighborhoods for Reform. 2 months before the Landmarks Commission hearing, neighbors were already at work. In May, we convened a citywide summit and held two others in the fall, drawing activists from 37 neighborhoods. The goal is twofold: save affordable housing and ensure more positive development. United Neighborhoods for Reform grew from these grassroots. Its steering committee includes teachers, planners, economists, and attorneys. Full disclosure, I am a recovering journalist and infill developer. Many of the ideas generated by the summits formed the basis of a demolition development resolution now endorsed by 39 neighborhood associations. And I have a map for that, Carla. Thank you. Yay. This document represents the boots-on-the-ground perspective often missing in the discussion over demolition and development. This is the voice of the early stakeholders in the city. As hundreds of homes, an average of 87 years old, head to the landfill, we lose more than quality, craftsmanship, and materials. We also lose affordable housing, economic diversity among neighbors, mature urban tree canopy, solar access for energy and vegetable gardens, and neighborhood character and history, and more. Comp Plan Policy 5.33 calls for preservation of small and affordable single-family homes. This resolution makes that priority a reality. In addition, we want to build on Portland's reputation as a green, sustainable city, one committed to public health and safety. Local preservationist Kathy Galbraith says, in Portland, we try to recycle everything but throw whole houses away. In those demolitions, toxic clouds of hazardous materials such as asbestos and lead are released uncontrolled into the environment. DRAC has done a fine job of eliciting developers' views. Aside from elimination of the K-1 exemption, which we agree with, we are not convinced that most of the recommendations would better manage home demolitions, and some may make things worse. In particular, neighborhoods should not lose protections earned 25 years ago, and they should not have to ask permission from the developer to request a demolition delay to save a home from the landfill. The most effective solution brings all interests to the table. Time and time again, neighbor involvement has improved developers' investment in our community. This resolution and its request for a task force that equitably represents Portland residents adds the voice of those who are most heavily impacted to conversations about the city's future. Let's protect what makes a city great, a range of well-built, affordable housing. And when we build, let's make a Portland that makes us proud. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Janet Baker. I live at 3416 Northeast
39. I'm going to just interrupt you for 1 second. You don't need to give your addresses. Okay. So just for the future.
I'm a member of the Beaumont-Wilshire Neighborhood Association Board and also a member of the UNR Steering Committee with Margaret. As Margaret told you in her testimony, a series of these summits started in the spring, drawing more than 100 participants from 37 neighborhoods. Ideas generated during these summits form the basis for the UNR resolution, which you have before you. In the spring, we also started attending DRAC meetings, although we had no official status in that group. The resolution was finalized in early November, and then the real work began. Members of the subcommittee, steering committee, contacted each of the Portland's 95 neighborhood associations offering to present the resolution before their association boards, land use committees, or neighborhood general meetings. To date, 39 associations have voted to support the resolution, as shown on Margaret's map, but it's a little hard to see the map, so I'm going to read those out to you. Alameda, Arbor Lodge, Ardenwood, Johnson Creek, Argay, Arlington Heights, Ash Creek, Beaumont, Wilshire, Brindlemile, what's a hard one to say, Brooklyn, Centennial, Concordia, East Columbia, Eastmoreland, Elliott, Grant Park, Hayhurst, Hosford, Abernethy, Humboldt, Irvington, King, Maplewood, Markham, Marshall Park, Mill Park, Mount Tabor, Multnomah, Northwest District Association, Overlook, Pleasant Valley, Powellhurst, Gilbert, Reed, Richmond, Roseway, Russell, South Burlingame, South Portland, Vernon, West Portland Park, Woodlawn. We also received a number of qualified endorsements from about a half dozen other neighborhood associations. Many of the neighborhood associations had no meeting during our time period from mid-November to now. A few called special board meetings to be able to vote on the resolution, but many of them have invited us to present the resolution to them when they have their first meeting again in January. We've been pleasantly surprised by the outpouring of support at these meetings. It's as if the resolution has touched a nerve among Portland residents. In my opinion, this was an incredible outreach effort in a very short window of time. Some members of our group, all volunteers, made 3 or 4 presentations a week to meetings that often stretched long into the night. The issues surrounding demolitions of Portland homes are not going to go away. Unless actions are taken, every day another Portland home will be torn down. Thank you very much for listening to us and to the neighborhoods that support the resolution.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
The next three are Barbara Strunk, Claire Coleman Evans, and Mary Ann Santana. And they'll be followed by Al Ellis, Fred Leeson, and James Gortner.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. My name is Barbara Strunk. I live in the Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood, and I'm a member of the United Neighborhoods for Reform. I was awakened to the trend of demolitions in our Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood this year when a beautifully maintained large brick house with leaded glass was bought by developers to demolish. I do not object to the replacement of unsound houses. However, when a developer tells me he is demolishing a good, iconic house instead of remodeling because he cannot make enough profit, then I do react. I looked beyond our block at what was happening in our entire neighborhood in the 2-year period, 2013-2014. In Beaumont-Wilshire alone, we have had 85 demolitions and new construction and remodels that have the impact of demolitions on our neighborhood. From data compiled from Portland maps, from building permits and realty ads, we have found that new houses on average are 2.3 times as big and 2.4 times as expensive as the houses they're replacing. Of 85 demolitions and large remodel projects, only 3 or 4% were done by homeowners who continued to live in the house. Demolition and development in Beaumont-Wilshire in 2013-2014 resulted in an increase of 13 houses. So much destruction for so little gain in density. The median price of these new houses is $766,000 compared to the median house price of all Beaumont-Wilshire houses of $449,000. Government officials we have talked with about this trend have stated that the demolition rate of 300 houses per year, demolition as currently described by the City of Portland, it would take 483 years to replace all the houses in Portland. In Beaumont-Wilshire, using the more common sense definition of demolition as the actual destruction of the house, the rate we are seeing will result in replacement of all current houses in 52 years or less. Even more chilling is a statement by another developer that all the bungalows in Beaumont Wilshire, an example of relatively affordable housing, will be gone in 10 years. Figures and statements like these go a long way toward explaining why so many Portland citizens feel an urgency to examine and slow this demolition development trend. The current demolition development activity in Beaumont Wilshire is not adding meaningfully to the general stock of housing or to the stock of a sustainable, affordable housing. I do not want to see my neighborhood become a place where the great majority of Portlanders cannot afford to live. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, members of council. My name is Claire Coleman Evans, and the video that I'm going to be showing you today.
Claire, can you move just a little closer to the mic so we can hear you?
Yeah. Sorry. The video that I'm going to show you today was made because of the King neighborhood resident, Fred Lifton, and there's a copy of his testimony that I gave to Carla. Who was mobilized to join United Neighborhoods for Reform caused by the demolitions in his neighborhood, in particular, one in which a classic Portland home that had been partitioned into a duplex was torn down to make way for a large, lightly constructed single-family home. The pictures making up the video are mostly of Northeast Portland homes, but in my neck of the woods, southwest Portland, I was awakened and shaken by the sound of a bulldozer ripping apart a perfectly good, affordable single-family home located at 4521 Southwest 60th Place. Every neighborhood probably has this litany of demolition tragedies. This is just part of the Portland story. Bill Dean's protest song, Don't Tear Them Down, which accompanies the pictures, came out of the Overton Miracle of 1989, in which 23 protesters were arrested trying to stop the demolition of homes on Northwest Overton and Pettigrove Street. Protests then included vandalism and arson, the unrest prompted changes into city code to preserve existing homes. The protections that we are fighting for, DRAC recommends drastically reducing the demolition delay that has helped save these homes. DRAC proposes to require that neighborhoods or people interested in saving the homes obtain the property's owner permission to request the delay. This song was offered in our efforts and hopes to save the affordable housing throughout Portland by Jacquay Markill, who was involved in the Overton Miracle, and Billy Oske, who produced this video.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carla.
And the video runs about, how do I do it? Okay, the video runs about 3 minutes, 40 seconds, so, Marianne Santana is going to take her time.
Thank you.
very much. Okay, let's take the next folks, please.
Okay, let's see, I believe it's Al Ellis, Fred Leeson, and James Gortner. And they'll be followed by John Sandy, Brandon Spencer Hartle, and Barbara Pierce.
I'll go ahead and get started in the interest of time. I'm Fred Leeson, Board President of Bosco Milligan Foundation and the Architectural Heritage Center. We've been an active member of the Portland Coalition for Historic Preservation and provide a venue for many of its meetings. This is starting to feel like a home away from home, and I'm sorry about that. One of our primary concerns entering this process was the definition of demolition. Many cities, including Ashland, Berkeley and Pasadena in California, and Amherst, Massachusetts, define it as a loss of a specified percent of roof structure or exterior walls, commonly 50 to 60%. Ashland is generous at 60%. We regret that DRAC chose not to accept this kind of definition as recommended by the Landmarks Commission. Instead of the idea of a 50 or 60% rule, the idea was to encompass the virtual demolitions that left little or nothing standing in the original house. These will now be captured by the major remodel category, a new category included in this package. At first, it seems to be a distinction without a difference, since the same 35 delay would apply to a demolition to as a major remodel. So why is the major remodel even there? I suspect there's some sort of gamesmanship going on here that I'm not smart enough to figure out, but maybe we will discover it in time. If the council adopts 120-day delay, as we hope it will, the potential for fudging becomes much more apparent. Leaving a chimney or a single door standing would be a major remodel rather than a demolition. The loophole would be almost big enough to drive a bulldozer through. I think there are always grounds for skepticism whenever any particular industry writes its own regulations. I appreciate Commissioner Fritz's amendment about gathering information over the next year. Tracking those statistics will help us determine how effective this will be. Not every house needs to be saved, but when the exceptions come along, we need to have tools that allow opportunities to protect them. Once they're gone, along with the adverse impacts on sustainability, moderate income housing, neighborhood compatibility, and sense of place. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
My name is Al Ellis, and I go by Al in my neighborhood, which is Beaumont-Wilshire. I'm formerly president of the Beaumont-Wilshire Neighborhood Association, and I chaired the United Neighborhoods for Reform summit meetings. And I've come here before wearing another hat. I'm president of the Portland-Cabota Sister City Association. You know, this whole issue was off the radar for us a couple of years ago, and I just finished my term as president of the Neighborhood Association last April. And all of a sudden, I was getting lots of emails, phone calls, people were showing up for general meetings about this issue. It caught us by surprise, and people wanting us to what can the Neighborhood Association do about this situation? And so we did a little research. I called up BDS. We decided to make a test case of a house, try to save a house that was an iconic house on a block, and it was quite a nice house. It was market value of $700,000, annual taxes of property tax of $9,000, and all the residents to a person on the block wanted to save it. So we made a test case, and I called up BDS and requested 120. This is, you know, it took us a while just to decide as a board, as a neighbor association board, to take on this case to try to save the house amidst all the other houses that were, in need of saving, according to residents. And so once we got to the situation, we needed a delay. We needed a time to sit down with the developer and the residents. So I called up BDS, and on the same day, we got the 120-day delay. So I sat down with the developer, with a representative from the resident, a representative from the neighborhood, from the block. And the first thing the developer said is, had I known early on that this was such an important house to the block, then I wouldn't have bought it for demolition. Now, I don't know whether he's telling me the truth, but he seemed sincere. And that, you know, that resonated. Well, we weren't successful in saving the house. In fact, we didn't even get the whole 120-day delay because of the K-1 that the developer was able to get around that and nullify the 120-day delay before it was over. So we're pleased that the DRAC committee is recommending eliminating the K-1 provision. So after that house was destroyed, you know, and we kept getting more and more emails, phone calls, et cetera, what could we do? Well, the comprehensive plan was something we could go to, but that was really far in the future. And DRAC, you know, the DRAC committee, well, that was, we had observers. We would go to the, we would have people from our neighborhood association go to the meetings, but it was observer status, and the developers who dominated the committee didn't seem, you know, favorable to the kinds of reforms we were talking about. And so what could we do? And so in the waning days of my presidency of the neighborhood association, I thought, what if we could bring together neighborhoods from around the around Portland who have similar concerns, craft some kind of common proposal of reforms, and bring it here to the council? And I had no idea whether we'd be able to pull that off. And so we had the summits, and we eventually called the organization United Neighborhoods for Reform, and here we are. And you can see that people are well organized. We have, you know, neighborhoods from all over Portland.
I need you to try to wrap up because we're using
time. And I just want to say that we're very pleased that, with the DRAC committee's recommendations, except for the, you know, elimination of the 120-day delay. We also, I think, the mayor hit it on the nail when he said that it needs a combination of front end and back end. I think that's really important. Commissioner Fish knows what the process is. He's going through it right now, living next door. And in closing, I just want to say that for thousands of residents around Portland, this issue is the elephant in the room when it comes to, you know, the quality of living in the neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Jim Gorder. I live in the South Burlingame neighborhood, and I'm speaking today on behalf of United Neighborhoods for Reform. As Ms. Thorington said, the DRAC recommendations before you do not cover the issue of hazardous materials. The Bureau of Development Services issues demolition permits, but it has not been given the authority to deal with these hazardous materials. Other cities in Oregon have rules for demolition, which require contractors to submit mitigation plans as part of the application process. Some require work to be done by certified workers and contractors. Ms. Thorington commented on a couple of cities' proposal or forms, which I have here. Tualatin demolition permit requirements says that DEQ requires an asbestos survey before any building may be demolished. A copy of the DEQ asbestos survey must be included in the permit application submittal. Lake Oswego says demolition permits must be accompanied by a certificate of compliance for asbestos and lead paint removal completed by an Oregon licensed abatement firm. We call on the City Council to convene a demolition hazardous materials task force to draw up new city code using the city's permitting and public safety authority consistent with applicable state law to ensure mitigation of lead, asbestos, and other hazardous materials at permitted demolition sites. As a minimum, Portland should require the submission of the demolition application, one, documentation of the presence of lead paint, asbestos, underground fuel tanks, and other hazardous materials, two, written hazmat handling, mitigation, and disposal plans, and three, identification of the demolition contractors and verification of current hazmat training and certification for the contractors and their workers. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Okay, and I understand we have another DRAC committee member here. Teresa, are you here? Professor Rayford? So we're going to give deference to committee members. Thank you.
Sorry, I get to cut the line.
Oh, you're not a DRAC committee member?
No, I'm with Jim Heuer and Architectural Heritage Center and all those guys. So should I wait?
Yes, please. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were on the committee. Never mind. I'm sorry, Teresa.
No problem.
So let's take the next three.
are John Sandy, Brandon Spencer Hartle, and Barbara Pierce. And they'll be followed by Wendy Chung, Barbara Kerr, and Terry Parker.
I think six. Yeah, I think we're going to be able to go to folks from, excuse me, I'll be able to speak here eventually. We're going to try to go to 6 o'clock. I know we're going to lose at least two members of the council then, so we got a little time left, but again, try to be succinct.
I think we should go 2 minutes after this.
Okay, ready to go? My name is John Sandy. I represent United Neighbors for Reform, and I'm thankful for being given the opportunity to speak today. Protecting the safety and health of its citizens is a core responsibility of any municipality's governing body. Mayor Hales said it himself in a recent op-ed, and I quote, "Government must ensure the safety of everyone," unquote. While previous speakers have addressed needs required prior to issuing a demolition permit, I'm going to focus on the demolition process itself. I'm requesting from the council the immediate use of best practices in residential housing demolitions in order to minimize potential health risks to the public. In the past 3 years, the city has approved over 750 residential demolition permits. Since most of these houses were built prior to 1950, there is no doubt that the asbestos and lead-based paint existed at a majority of these sites. The health hazards of asbestos and lead-based paint are well publicized and widely accepted. As this demolition activity increases, your urgent and immediate action is required to implement responsible demolition procedures. And I have references to any study I'm going to talk about in the information I've given to the clerk. A HUD-sponsored study by U of C to gather data during housing demolitions in Chicago resulted in these three key findings. One, significant amounts of lead dust is emitted by demolition of older homes, often in excess of established thresholds. Two, improvement of dust suppression techniques is needed to minimize the spread of this lead dust. Three, lead dust fall was detected at distances 300 feet from demolition perimeters. This HUD study was born from an earlier East Baltimore responsible demolition study. While there are many broad recommendations from the East Baltimore case study regarding responsible demolitions, there are two that outline simple steps to drastically reduce the public's risk. One, perform partial deconstruction of homes, removing doors, windows, railings, and other components with high amounts of lead prior to the demolition. Two, provide adequate wetting of the structure and debris to minimize dust spread. While the EPA and its state designate, the Oregon Health Authority, have broad and detailed procedures for lead-based paint and renovations, repairs, and painting program, they are silent on whole house demolitions. When you consider the minimum thresholds for activating the procedures during renovation is disturbing just 6 square feet of lead-based material, it's clear the current whole house demolitions are in dire need of similar sets of guidelines and inspections. For the above reasons, I request the immediate development and issuing of rather simple best practices for responsible house demolitions coupled with appropriate inspections. For it is my desire for each of the council members to be able to answer unequivocally yes to the mother who lives next to a demolition site when she asks, "Is it safe for my kids to go out and play?" Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mayor, Council, my name is Brandon Spencer Hartle. I'm the Senior Field Programs Manager at Restore Oregon. Restore Oregon is a statewide historic preservation organization. Our mission is literally to save historic places. Since the beginning of this year, I've devoted approximately 300 hours of my professional time to working on this issue. I've responded to dozens of local requests for technical assistance, worked with city staff to research the impacts of demolition, conducted a series of demolition pub education programs, and have attended almost all of the DRAC subcommittee meetings. I am here today to oppose the recommended replacement of the existing 120-day delay extension with what amounts to a 30-day token extension. Retaining a meaningful demolition delay extension is of paramount importance to the historic preservation community. There are four reasons this is the case. First, in Oregon, historic designation requires the consent of an owner. Unless a historically significant house has been formally designated as a landmark, it is not protected by the zoning code. Without the opportunity for additional delay in Title 24, Portland will continue to lose buildings that are eligible for landmark listing but have not yet been designated. Two, saving a historic building takes time. At Restore Oregon, one of my key responsibilities is to save the annual list of Oregon's most endangered places. Typical due diligence, such as performing a condition assessment, commissioning a feasibility study, finalizing a pro forma, and mobilizing grassroots support, generally takes 6 months or longer. Under the Drax proposal, the community cannot reasonably be expected to save historic places. Third, as evidenced in the findings in the ordinance in front of you, demolition delay extensions are rarely requested by neighborhood associations. Removing this important neighborhood power will result in less communication with developers and will represent a reversal of decades of public policy to assist neighborhood associations in the work that they do. Fourth and finally, 120 days is the appropriate and legally defensible amount of time. For example, the zoning code mandates a 120-day demolition delay review for proposals to demolish local and conservation landmarks. ORS 197772 specifies that no demolition permit can be issued within 120 days of an owner objecting to historic designation. And finally, ORS 227178 specifies that cities must take final action on land use permits within 120 days. These local and state laws align with the time frame that's existed in Portland's Title 24 for two decades. After participating in this process, I've gained a great amount of respect for both DRAC and city staff. I'm not here today to criticize the process, but I am here to say that as much as it represents a step forward, the loss of 120 days would represent a significant step backwards for the work that the Historic Preservation and Neighborhood Association communities do here in Portland. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I know it's late, Mayor, but I just you've raised an issue that I haven't heard before, and I just want to give you a chance to answer this question. What percentage of the houses that are currently subject to demolition, in your view, might be eligible for some historic designation?
So in Portland, we have individual and district designation. So there are many districts that currently are eligible, but with the erosion of the existing housing stock, wouldn't be eligible. If we take that out of the equation and just look at the individual houses one by one as landmarks, 5% maybe. I don't have an exact number.
Five?
Yeah, maybe. We're not talking about a significant chunk. I know we're talking about a majority or anywhere close to a majority that would be eligible.
If it's 5%, do you have a suggestion for us that gets at the 5% without applying a rule that then would snare the other 95%?
So what I would recommend is right now we have the 120-day provision. I would recommend that the council keep that, and then in 18 months we come back and see how effective that's been. If it's abused by neighborhood associations, obviously we would change course. But right now we're looking at somewhere between 3 and 8% of demolition permits have asked for that 120 days, depending on whose data you look at. So at the current time, I don't think we're using it egregiously, and I'd be interested to see under the rest of the draft recommendations whether or not it was used appropriately.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi. My name is Barbara Pierce, and I'm here today representing the Architectural Heritage Center, where I'm the marketing manager, and also the Save the Markham Home campaign team. I'm a volunteer on the Markham team and help lead the campaign along with Jennifer Moffitt, CJ Hurley, and Mark Miller. And today I specifically want to address the importance of retaining the 120-day demolition delay. The Markham Home is one of Portland's rare Mission Revival style homes and sits at the Gleason Street entrance gates to Laurelhurst, and I think most of us have followed some of that anyway. The home was on the Historic Resources Inventory but was removed at the owner's request earlier this year. In June, the home was purchased by Peter Kusick of Forenza Development. Peter bought the home with the intention of demolishing it and building two new buildings, one of which would have been a duplex. Neighbors rallied immediately when we learned of the plans and asked the Laurelhurst Neighborhood Association to request the 120-day delay. We soon learned that Peter was planning to use the K1 exception loophole to get around the delay, but we moved ahead, started a petition to gain community support, and developed a social media campaign to help spread the word. After seeing that we were serious and passionate about our efforts, Peter agreed to meet with us. While he was unapologetic about his plans, he was also willing to work with us if we could show him that we had a chance of success. He gave us a very short deadline to find a serious buyer. And while our team was dedicated and felt we had a responsibility to our community and supporters, we started our search knowing that without a 120-day delay, we really had no chance of success. Fortunately, we quickly connected with contractor John McCulloch, who committed to buy and rehab the home, but we still had a tremendous amount of work to be done by our team, including raising $35,000 needed to make the purchase feasible for John. In the end, our process and ultimate success took about 120 days, but during that time, we scrambled to meet every deadline set with Peter and had to ask for extensions at each phase. Peter worked with us, but every time we needed an extension, our focus had to shift and our work was delayed, so we really weren't doing what we needed to be doing. If we had the 120-day delay period, it would have freed up our team to focus on our project at hand rather than responding to repetitive crises each time we needed an extension. Our team believes that most other developers would not have worked so well with us, and the 120-day delay would have been the only way to have the necessary time to succeed. We support the United Neighborhoods for Reform proposal to retain the existing language in city code, providing for a 120-day residential demolition delay upon request by recognized neighborhood association or neighborhood coalition, with the understanding that a good faith effort be made by the association to find an alternative to demolition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. So we might want to try to get people to stay within 2 minutes now, just so we can try to get 15 more people in.
The next three are Wendy Chung, Barbara Kerr, and Terry Parker, and they'll be followed by Jim Huer, Jim Brown, and Gary Clifford.
15 more people in.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, Commissioners. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am an NWDA board member and a member of the NWDA Planning Committee. We are grateful for the hard work of DRAC aimed at addressing citywide concerns about demolition. The document that Carla will hand you will probably answer some of what Commissioner Fish asked earlier about the 5% to Spencer Hartle, but I'd like to reserve that comment for after my testimony. It takes an enormous amount of coordination to pool resources and develop alternatives to save a house from demolition. I experienced this firsthand last spring during the effort to save the Goldsmith House on Northwest 24th and Quimby. Both as a member of the NWDA and as one of the neighbors who pitched in to buy it from the developer. At one of our meetings last spring, NWDA was presented plans already underway to demolish the Goldsmith House and the house on the lot next to it to make way for row homes. We hurried over to the house from our meeting. Workmen were already removing interior pieces of the house and placing them on the porch or along the driveway.